So what'll be happening is I'll be introducing our guest speaker in just a moment. We're going to be going over some of the things that happened since last month's call, going over the actions for this month for the U.S. and Canada, and then the most important thing we do every month is getting into action. One thing I want to mention at the start here is that if you were looking for us 10 years ago, you wouldn't have found us, because we didn't actually start until October of 2007. So this October, we will do something to commemorate that this is 10 years that we've been in existence. But if you look back, in October of 2007, there was one chapter. That's what CCL was 10 years ago. At this point, there's 383 chapters, 37 of which are in Canada. In Africa, we have chapters in 10 countries, in Asia in 4 countries, in Europe in 9 countries, in Latin America 5, and in the Pacific, Australia, New Zealand, with the Philippines working to come on also. There's also 249 groups that are in the process of either starting or building a brand new chapter. So you all are doing a really remarkable job of continuing to build the organization. I wanted to also mention that I will give everybody an update on the Climate Solutions Caucus today. And one of the things that I want to mention about it is it's really important that we call it the Climate Solutions Caucus, because we bring people on two at a time, one Republican, one Democrat. Some people refer to it as the Noah's Ark Caucus. And when we do that, the members of the Climate Solutions Caucus don't like it. Now, there might be a Noah's Ark Caucus. Maybe there's some group out there who thinks that we're going to fail and therefore they got to prepare for some dystopian future. But if we would be disciplined about calling the Climate Solutions Caucus the Climate Solutions Caucus, that would be really good, and it would make the people on the caucus very happy. Before I introduce our speaker, I just want to tell her a little bit about the people on the call. So Devashree, the people who you're talking to will probably get more done every month to advance solutions to climate change than many people who work on this will ever do. I mean, I just want to give you a few examples of what happened this month alone. So, you know, I don't know how many people on this call have ever tried to get an op-ed published, but it's hard. It's hard to write something that's good enough to worthy to publish in the paper. It's hard to get the paper to publish it. So anytime it happens for one person, it's remarkable. The people on this call published 75 op-eds this month. So just in the month of February, published 75 op-eds. It's also even more difficult than that to get a newspaper to take the position that they should support our legislative proposal and therefore write an editorial. And there were 14 editorials in the month of February alone supporting our proposal. In addition to that, there were 272 letters to the editor published by our people and 60 meetings with congressional offices. So the people you're talking to won't take any of the information you present today casually. They'll get into action, and they won't just get into any action, but they'll get into meaningful action. Okay, a little bit about our speaker. So Devashree Saha is a senior policy associate and associate fellow at the Brookings Institution Metropolitan Policy Program. Her research primarily focuses on the intersection of clean energy and economic development policy, including the transition to a clean energy economy. Prior to joining Brookings, Saha worked at the National Government Association, where her work spanned clean energy, transportation, and land use planning issues. She holds a PhD in public policy from the University of Texas at Austin and a master's in political science from Purdue University. So we first saw the paper that she co-authored with Mark Murrow titled Growth, Carbon, and Trump, State Progress and Drift on Economic Growth and Emissions Decoupling. So when we saw that, we wanted to have her come on and talk about what she means by decoupling. So Devashree, thank you so much for making yourself available on a Saturday. And can you please tell us a little bit about what you mean about decoupling?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Mark. And I'm really happy to be on this call, even on a Saturday, because this is an issue, you know, that is not just of, you know, professional interest to me. I'm also deeply, you know, vested in it, you know, from the, you know, personal point of view. So I'm really happy to have, you know, so many folks join the call, and very excited to, you know, share my research work. So before I, you know, start talking about decoupling and what it means for the United States, and especially what it means in the current political climate, I just want to give you a very quick background, about the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. So MPP, our mission is really to deliver research and solutions that help cities and metropolitan areas build an advanced economy that works for all. And the reason why we choose to focus on cities and metro areas is because we believe that, these are the geographies which are the true hubs of the national and the global economy. Crucially, cities and metro areas concentrate the economic assets that provide the foundation for an advanced economy. And by this, I mean the rich and diverse human capital, the modern infrastructure that protects the environment, facilitates economic activity, and improves access to opportunity, and even the trading relationships that engage the global marketplace. So we believe that cities and metro areas, and increasingly states, these are the subnational entities where the rubber really, meets the road, so to speak. So in my research, I look at climate and energy issues from the state and regional perspective. So that's sort of, the quick background, about the Metropolitan Policy Program and, my research. So today I'm going to talk about research that I did with my co-author Mark Muro on decoupling, which essentially means, delinking of economic growth from growth in carbon emissions. So if you really think about it, conventional views on the relationship between economic growth and energy consumption and also emissions has been that, that economic growth is always going to lead to an increase in production, and therefore there's going to be an increase in, energy use and emissions. And, for most of the 20th century, we have seen this, very divisive face-off between, the growth imperative on, on the one hand, and the climate imperative on the other hand. And yet, in recent years, more and more data is beginning to confirm that it is actually possible to address global climate challenges, while preserving economic growth and prosperity. And I think, that's why the whole topic of, decoupling becomes, so important, because it represents the squaring of the circle necessary to decarbonize the global economy. We know that, deep reductions in carbon emissions will be necessary to, transition to a low carbon economy, which is consistent with the collective vision to, holding the world's climate to a 2 degrees Celsius or even less of warming. And, there's data which actually shows that, global emissions of greenhouse gas emissions have to reduce 40 to 70% from their, 2010 level by 2050 and almost zero by the century's end. So if you think about it, then, such an accomplishment will entail a profound transformation of, every sector of the economy. So that's why, the whole topic of, decoupling of economic growth from growth in carbon emissions is actually so important. Can we move to the next slide, the second slide? So this slide actually, for people who can't see it, is just, showing data from, 2000 to 2015, and it's showing how, at the global level, how there has been a change in real GDP and CO2 emissions since 2020. So how are these two metrics, GDP and CO2 emissions, how have they been, changing over the course of the last, 14 or 15 years? So In 2014, the International Energy Agency reported that energy-related CO2 emissions were flat, despite an increase of around 3% in global GDP. So actually, for the first time in 40 years, there was a reduction in emissions, carbon emissions, that was not tied to an economic crisis. And then in 2015, the globe repeated the feat. So we had sort of, decoupling happen at the global level in 2014 and then in 2015. Can we move to the next slide, slide 3? So this is a slide which shows, and this is actually data that I've taken from, the World Resources Institute, another think tank, which looked at the issue of, decoupling from the perspective of, how nations are doing. So the World Resources Institute looked at data for, 67 countries, and it found that, since 2000, more than 20 countries, mostly in, the advanced economies in, Europe and North America, they have reduced their annual greenhouse gas emissions while, growing their economies. And, so this slide actually, shows, lists the, the 20 countries from Austria to even, United Kingdom, United States, and Uzbekistan. And it shows for the period 2000 to 2015, what has been the change in carbon emissions and what has been the change in GDP over the same period. So for instance, for United Kingdom, you can see that, over the full 14-year period, the UK reduced its carbon emissions while, growing its economy by, 27%. So basically, decoupling is, well underway in a handful of nations. That's the point that I, want you guys to take from this slide. Can we move to the next slide, which is slide number 4. So this actually shows the US data on decoupling. So again, looking at the period from 2000 to 2015, showing the trends in, change in real GDP and CO2 emissions. And here you see that the United States first decoupled its economic growth and emissions in 2001, when it actually achieved a very modest 2% reduction in carbon emissions while, growing its economy by 1%. Keep in mind that 2001 was a recession year, but, decoupling occurred again in 2006, which was a year of solid growth, and then, it kind of relapsed. And more recently, the United States, has been decoupling emissions and growth from 2010 to 2012, and then again in, 2015. So the point that I'm trying to make here is that emissions decoupling in the United States has clearly become more and more frequent. And there are a lot of, reasons, why, decoupling is occurring in the United States. And that's, a lot of it has to do with the ongoing large-scale switch from, coal to natural gas, which has been driven by, hydraulic, basically the fracking boom. At the same time, there are, numerous other factors which are, clearly influencing outcomes here. You can think about, changes in the structure and growth of the national economy, like how we are moving from a goods manufacturing to a services-oriented economy. So that could be, another potential factor. Then, investment decisions and technology changes to, land use change. And again, or more importantly, the availability of clean new energy resources, including, renewables. So all these different factors definitely are, at play here, which are helping the United States to sort of, decouple energy carbon emissions while at the same time, growing its economy. Can we move to the next slide, which is slide 5? So this actually, so from here, I'm going to sort of shift gear and talk about decoupling, you know, at the state level. And I think this is an important pivot, you know, for a variety of reasons. You know, states and cities are crucial players in the carbon drama because, you know, they retain a unique and strong influence over, you know, multiple policy levers that can actually control emissions. I mean, think about it. You know, states are the entities that set, you know, state-level carbon emission rules and renewable targets. They regulate investor-owned electric utilities. They shape land use rules and building codes and transportation systems. So it is, you know, very safe to say that, you know, progress to meet national targets is going to depend heavily on state and local policy. And I want you all to keep that in mind because this is definitely becoming going to become more and more important in the new political climate that we find ourselves in. So again, we gathered data on, you know, state real GDP figures and, you know, carbon emissions data from the Energy Information Administration. And we looked at the period between 2000 and 2014. And we found that during this period, 33 states and the District of Columbia have managed to expand their economies while reducing their, you know, carbon emissions. Of course, you know, among all these, you know, states that decoupled, the pace and extent of, you know, decoupling, you know, varies from place to place. So we kind of divided the 33 states and District of Columbia into, you know, three different groups. You know, one called, you know, the high decouplers, the medium decouplers, and, you know, the weak decouplers. So among the high decouplers, we find that there are about, I think about 11 states, you know, ranging from, you know, District of, you know, Columbia, Maine, Massachusetts, you know, Alaska, Maryland, Delaware, New York, Tennessee, Nevada, Connecticut, Georgia, and Virginia. You know, these are states which during the study period from 2000 to 2014 actually achieved significant reduction in carbon emissions while at the same time, you know, achieving, you know, double digit economic growth, except maybe, you know, Maine, which kind of, you know, Maine is, you know, sort of among the states, it achieved sort of the maximum reduction in carbon emissions. It reduced its carbon emission by 25% during this, you know, the study period, and it kind of, at the same time, grew its economy by, you know, 9%. Other states like Massachusetts, you know, had, again, you know, significant reduction, but, you know, grew at like, you know, 21% GDP. So these are, you know, like states, you know, with, which we called, you know, the high decoupling states. The trend for decoupling is, you know, strongest among these 11 states and DC. And we found that collectively, these places reduced their emissions by 19% while expanding their GDP by a robust 22%. Can we move to the next slide, which is slide six? This one shows that, you know, eight states like South Carolina, Kansas, California, Wisconsin, Kentucky, Florida, Minnesota, and Hawaii, these eight states experienced a weaker form of decoupling. Collectively, you know, these states were able to reduce their emissions by only 6%, you know, compared, and at the same time, they had a very robust GDP growth of, you know, 25%. So the fact that, you know, California sort of, you know, showed up in this group of states, which we are calling, you know, the weak decouplers was, you know, a little surprising to us that, you know, despite its record of, you know, adopting stringent climate action policies, You know, California reduced its emission only by a modest, 6%, while expanding its economy by 28%. And, you know, there could be a few things going on here. The most important that we are guessing is that California had a low presence of coal-fired power generation to begin with in 2000, the start of our data, which kind of, deprives it of the leading mechanism for reduction in carbon emission, which is basically, fuel switch to coal plant, which is basically the fuel switch from, coal-powered generation to, natural gas-powered generation. So maybe that explains why, carbon emission reduction has been modest in California. Can we move to the next slide, which is slide 7? So far, I talked about, the 33 states and the District of Columbia, which kind of decoupled and, then talked about the high decouplers and the strong decouplers and the weak decouplers. So finally, our data reveals that 16 states have not decoupled, and they have instead experienced, rising emissions and rising GDP. And actually, a few of these places have seen dramatic increases in emissions. And, of course, Nebraska tops the list here. For Nebraska, the change in GDP during 2000 to 2014 was 37%. It grew its economy by 37%, and at the same time, it increased its carbon emission by 26%. That's the highest increase. Other states in this category include North Dakota, which had a phenomenal 128% growth in GDP while increasing its carbon emissions by 16%. Then other states like Arkansas, Arizona, South Dakota, Colorado, Idaho, which gets so much of its electricity from hydro, despite its dependence on hydropower generation, Idaho is also increased its carbon emissions. So, obviously other factors affecting what's going on in this state. Places, like Iowa, Oklahoma, Mississippi, Wyoming, Montana, Texas, Utah, these are all places, which grew their, economy and also, increased their emissions. So can we move to the next slide, which is, slide, I think, 8. So I'm sorry that, some of you can't, see the, the PowerPoint presentation, but I feel that, this slide is visually very gripping. So basically, it's a map of the United States, showing, showing all the states. And you can clearly see by the way that they have been, color-coded that, the Northeast and, Southern states actually lead in carbon emissions decline. States in these two regions have achieved, some of the largest, carbon emissions decline, and they have also sort of, grown their economies. And can you move to slide number 9, which just shows the presents the same argument sort of in a different way. And again, bar graphs showing the Midwest, the Northeast, the South, and the West. And you can see that the Northeastern states achieved 15% reduction in carbon emissions while they grew their economies by 19%. So the Northeastern states clearly stand out in terms of decoupling, and then followed by the Southern states, where collectively the Southern states emission reduction is only 7%, but it's still quite significant. Places like Georgia, Tennessee, Maryland, they they stand out among the southern states. And you can see that the Midwest and also a lot of places in the West, you see very sort of slow reduction, in carbon emissions, while still, managing, to grow their economy significantly. And can we move to the next slide, which is slide, 10? And I'm just, going to explain, provide, the gist of it. So, whatever I've, talked about so far, that, the United States has been, decoupling, and you see that, in multiple years, which is a good thing, right? Because it's becoming more and more frequent. If it's, just a one-off thing or happens in a couple of years, it could be just, an outlier. But the fact that, you're seeing this trend in multiple years, it's a very positive thing. Then I talked about, the states and the fact that, 33 states and the District of Columbia have managed to decouple. That's a great thing. But at the same time, there's a very sobering thought in the sense that there's still a very big gap between where we are, as a nation, and what is actually needed to meet the 2 degrees Celsius, target. On average, carbon intensity in the United States has fallen by just, 1.3%, each year since 2000. And compared to the 1.3%, that historically we have seen since 2000, the U.S. will actually need to decarbonize its economy by, 4.3% a year from now on, till 2030. So, right, comparing 1.3, what we have been seeing every year, and 4.3, where we need to be. So clearly, we are falling short on that goal. We significantly need to ramp up on, decarbonizing our economy. If we really want to, meet our, targets. So I won't go into too much detail into slide 10 and 11, given that a lot of, people can't, see, the slides, but, the short point here is that huge gap, decoupling is happening, very positive, very good story, but still a huge, huge gap between where we are and where we need to be if we realistically aim to meet our climate targets. So with that, I'll sort of, take a pause here and, see, what questions you have and, your reactions to what I have just talked about and anything you want to throw at me.
Okay, Devashree, fantastic. So we're going to have you back another time for questions, because this is absolutely fascinating. And one of the things that I think is so important about what you're pointing to is one of the ways that people who don't want us to take action on climate say is that it's going to be a drag on the economy, it's going to hurt growth, and so then end of discussion. And your data, your arguments, how well it's put together show that that argument just doesn't hold water. So this is a really, really important piece for us. There are other aspects to it that are important. I hope a lot of people read your paper. I certainly hope that we can have you back for a Q&A session, because I think this one particular piece is one of the places where we easily get tripped up. And the one question that came up quite a few times on the chat is could we get access to these slides that you shared so that we can show them to members of Congress when we have visits with them?
Absolutely. Please, go ahead and use these slides. I mean, whatever, data and research we produce, it's for the public.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you so much. And you're welcome to stay on for the next few minutes as we go over a few things that happened since last month's call and what we're going to do this month. But if you need to drop off, we understand it's a Saturday. Mm-hmm. I'm amazed that as many people show up on Saturdays as do. Okay.
Thank you.
We'll get the slides out to everybody. Yeah, thank you. And everybody, listen, we'll get the slides to you. Don't worry. That we'll get them out to the groups. Not to worry about that. Okay, so a couple of things. You know, I mentioned at the start of the call that we had 75 op-eds and 14 editorials. Both of those are complete record breakers. So what you're doing right now, I think, is the correct answer to what's happening. It'd be really easy to be fretting our hands and, you know, wringing our hands and fretting. But the amount of action this month, I believe, is the exact right, appropriate answer to what's happening. So again, a record number of op-eds, a record number of editorials. That's fantastic work. I also want you to know that in February, we got enough endorsements in that we now are over 1,000 endorsements. So for everybody who's been working on the endorsements, congratulations, great work on that. Also, since the first of the year, we've had regional and state conferences in Claremont, California, Atlanta, Georgia, Austin, Texas, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Berkeley, California, Golden, Colorado, and Seattle, Washington. 1,161 people registered for those conferences. So there's a lot of people have been getting together to continue our work. For the June conference right now, there are 550 people registered. At this time last year, there were 280. So if you're planning on coming in June, get yourself registered. Make sure you get yourself a spot. And then also, I want you to know that there's a little pre-boot camp for those of you who want to be complete in the weed policy wonks. You can search boot camp on our website and figure out how to come a little bit early if you want to come to that event. One of the things that I think caused a lot of consternation for many people was seeing that when Carbon Washington happened, the attacks were from the environmental justice groups. And that was surprising to a lot of people about that those are the people who'd be attacking the price on carbon. So, you know, that's another thing that people can fret about. But I want to tell you what Pasadena Foothills did last week. What they did is they held a day of dialogue in an attempt to learn how to unite the left. Attendees came from Food and Water Watch, Sierra Club, California Interfaith Power and Light, Southern California 350, and CCL, 5 from each group. The ask of the day was, what is your plan for solving the climate crisis? Each organization had the opportunity to hear each climate plan's pros, cons, political strategy, and therefore develop common ground. Now, you know, that's, to me, that's hard but remarkable work. And Pasadena and Foothills, thank you for doing that. I think more groups will replicate that effort because it is so remarkable. And for the people who were on the committee for Pasadena Foothills, Peter Eisenhart, Jeon Fried, Eileen Hattrick, Robert Ha, Carol Kravitz, John Adele, Roberta Preskill, thank you. I think that that's important, remarkable work, and I think that you'll find a lot of us will end up copying it. Okay, I want to talk about what we're doing in the U.S. and Canada and give you an update on the Climate Solutions Caucus. In Canada, we're focusing in two areas this month. One, we're focusing on reaching out to Rotary because there's a huge Rotary event in Canada this year and we want to maximize the opportunity and also organizing for Earth Day. The three things we're doing in the U.S. is asking people to raise money for Citizens Climate Lobby, which I'll come back to in 1 second, focusing on letters to the editor. This is the noisiest time I've ever been in. I've never been in a time where just life seems so noisy. And so we want to make sure we're being noticed and getting a lot of letters to editor published is really important at this time. And then the third thing is to practice this month's laser talk. I think most people on the call know that we have two organizations, Citizens Climate Lobby and Citizens Climate Education. Citizens Climate Lobby is the organization we know ourselves mostly of. But for the most part, when people donate, they donate to Citizens Climate Education because CCE is a 501c3, meaning that if you donate, you get a tax write-off for doing so, and that's what we want people to do. We want people to donate and make sure that they also get a tax write-off. Citizens Climate Lobby is a 501c4. That means when people donate to Citizens Climate Lobby, they don't get a write-off, but it is where we do some of our important work also. So what we want to do is add a couple of people to our DC office. So right now you have Danny Richter, Stephanie Doyle in a little tiny office, and basically Jay Butera as a full-time volunteer. What we would like to do is add a couple of people who are familiar with the Hill, who could coordinate with our liaisons that be on the Hill every single day, continuing to build the Climate Solutions Caucus, continuing to coordinate with our liaisons and developing political will with the congressional offices. So if you know people who can contribute, but they don't need the write-off, then would you reach out to them and ask them to contribute to Citizens Climate Lobby? What we want is just enough money to add a couple people and a little bit more office space. If you've ever stopped at our office space in DC, it's even smaller than our space in Coronado. So if we could add a couple of people, have a little bit more room. And again, we don't want you to change your donation. So if you're currently contributing to CCE, please just keep contributing to CCE. But if you know people who it wouldn't be an issue or a problem for them to donate and not get a write-off, if you'd reach out to them, that would be great, because I think we can make a really big difference by adding a few people at the DC office. Okay, quick update on the Climate Solutions Caucus. So next week, the caucus chairs will announce 6 new members. That will get us up to 30. Incredibly, 9 Republicans have joined in just the last few months. That means we cover 16 states now: Utah, Nevada, Illinois, and Nebraska, plus coastal states, Florida, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Maryland, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Vermont. And then on the left coast, now California, Washington, and Oregon. Jay had a meeting with Mr. Deutsch and Mr. Corbello, the two chairs of the Climate Solutions Caucus, and they made a point of saying that what's growing the caucus is you asking your members to join, your letters talking about the caucus, your op-eds mentioning the caucus. So they wanted to make sure that it went back to you, that saying they're getting the message, they're hearing it through other members of you reaching out to them, and they're seeing it in your op-eds and your letters to the editor. Okay, last two things. You know, some people say, oh, it's just a caucus. You know, caucuses don't do anything. And I know that many people were disappointed in what the head of the EPA said last week about CO2 emissions. And I wanted to read to you what Mr. Corbello, the Republican chair of the Climate Solutions Caucus, said. So here was his official statement. Representative Carlos Corbello, Florida 26, co-founder and chair of the Bipartisan Climate Change Solutions Caucus, released the following statement commenting on EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt's comments regarding CO2 emissions. Rising carbon emissions have been a contributing factor to climate change for decades. That is a scientific fact and a reality facing communities like my district. The EPA is tasked with the very responsibility of helping people to lower the impact of carbon emissions. And for Mr. Pruitt to assert otherwise without scientific evidence is reckless and unacceptable. So I want you to know that our Climate Solutions Caucus is out there doing things that we want them to do. Okay, next month, we're very excited. A woman who was really integral in the Pentagon transitioning from fossil fuels to renewable energy, an expert in that area, and really helped to make that transition. Again, I think we'll provide another important piece. I think today's piece is really, really important, because one of the things that tries to stop discussion about solving climate change is it's going to be a drag on the economy. What our speaker's study shows is you just can't make that argument based on evidence. All right, everybody, thanks for all you're doing. Again, that was a remarkable month last month. It just means you got to beat it this month. Thanks, everybody. Have a great month. We'll see you in a month. Bye now.